You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. David Haynes is the author of Right By My Side, Somebody Else's Mama, All American Dream Dolls, Welcome to Your World, Writings for the Heart of Young Americans, The Everyday Magic of Wardley Higgins, The Fool Matilda, A Star in the Face of the Sky, and his newest collection is Martha's Daughters and Other Stories. Thank you for joining me, David.
My pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
You know, David, this book is a remarkably brilliant collection of stories. It's incredibly funny, and yep, your sense of humor is a sense of understanding, I think, and that's what makes it so funny. And what conveys your sense of understanding is the miraculous prose. Did this just pour off the tip of your pen?
Well, I do think it's part of my sensibility. You know, one of the things that I think about the humor in the book is, and that I would like to point out about it from my perspective is, I think a lot of it is, first of all, a lot of it are the things that people think but don't say, including the author. And including all the characters. I mean, you know, a lot of it would be just brutal if people actually said some of these kinds of things to each other, right?
Exactly.
And then I think the other part of it is, and I think this is, you know, from a craft standpoint, then one of the secrets to writing good comic fiction is that it's in the rhythms of the prose, right?
And, exactly.
And what I find is that if I write a passage and to me it just isn't hitting right, it's not, you can't quite tinker with it. Sometimes you have to go back and rewrite the entire passage in order to get the rhythms that help make the humor land the way that you want it to.
You know, I think too is that you said that we see what the characters think but don't say, and we also read what the characters say as opposed to what they're thinking. And I think you also use, you know, the surprise effect of humor, which is that occasionally these characters will just be brutally honest and say exactly what they're thinking and kind of what you're thinking. And that comes as such a surprise to us that, you know, it evokes that startled laughter because that's the only thing you could do.
Right. I think that one of the things we're talking about, of course, is irony and, and the fact that, sometimes the characters are just so on a, you know, the story or the situation is on this course and the character says something or thinks something that's over here and the juxtaposition between those two things is crazy. But also, I think, as you're noting, sometimes the most hilarious things that are said in conversation are things when people are just being direct. And yes, sometimes those things are also really also cruel, right? But people, you know, those of us who believe that we are polite people and good people are, we try to, you know, hew to the social norm of, you know, not being rude or not being too direct in public. And then when you meet somebody who is just completely puts it out there, you know, it's kind of funny. And we're laughing at how uncomfortable it makes us, I think, too, that people can be that direct or dare to be that direct.
Well, also, one of the things I loved about this whole book is that it makes very entertaining the lives of people who are in the lower class, the lower middle class, and maybe clinging on by their fingertips to the middle class. This is a set of characters that, to be, I rarely find in fiction. Usually, you know, you'll get a few, maybe you'll get some, you know, scrubby down and outs in a piece of fiction. But there's, you know, always like millionaires and billionaires and people who are super competent at this or that. And with it, when I read this book, one of the closest analogs I found is, you know, arguably America's greatest and best-selling writer right now, Stephen King.
Who, hopefully not that dark.
No, I think you're Stephen King kind of without the gore, but you have that the same sensibility he has. If you read a lot of his books, his characters are not superstars. They're not superheroes. They're not much of anything except in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think that your focus on this class of America is really important. It was made the reading to me much more pleasurable because I could really identify with all these people. There are, you know, as I said, they're clinging with their fingertips to whatever economic part of the ladder they're on. So talk about looking at the lives of real Americans in the 21st century. And since you are writing in the 20th century, you've been doing this for a long time, talk about the contrast. Has anything changed for you?
Has anything changed for me? Is a somewhat different question, I think. Mm-hmm. Then has anything changed for the characters that I write about?
Well, but I'm asking both questions.
Both questions. So let me answer the first question first. I think that for me, what resonates with me with your question is that so many of the depictions of people in all kinds of narrative, whether it's you know, fiction or television, film, are folks who, you know, lead pretty amazing lives. You know, they live in fabulous apartments, or and often they live in you know, the best parts of the great cities, or in very stereotypical suburban neighborhoods that are with lovely manicured lawns.
And there's always parking, ample parking.
Always ample parking, and they all have great, great wardrobes. A lot of my characters, with perhaps the exception of the character, the narrator of the novella, Cynthia, are folks who whose lives are markedly lower middle class, and I would actually just describe these as just working folks. They're the kind of folks that get up and go to work every day, and you know, their lives are not particularly glamorous or extraordinary. But you're right. I think their lives are fairly much missing from a lot of storytelling. And it's because if you're in a, you know, just to get slightly political here, or actually cultural, this is more of a cultural criticism than a political one. If the medium is about sort of selling a lifestyle, which is particularly television and movies, there's not a lot to sell in terms of living in a fairly ordinary apartment with ordinary furniture. I mean, you know, you can't, you know, sell a lot of, it's not glamorous, right? But those lives are interesting and important all the same, right? I think that for those characters, I don't think a lot ever changes. You know, I think that in fact, you know, the economy goes up, the economy comes down, and they're still going to be struggling week to week to pay the bills. Maybe the big difference in some of their lives is because they've always lived that way, they've got a lot more strategies about how to survive, right? They have a lot more recipes for casseroles that are going to last a week.
Yeah, I can attest to that myself.
Yeah. And so And you know, they know their way around the discount grocery store and also the sale aisle at the grocery store, those products that the store just decided, you know, so that sort of tucked away someplace in this, you know, in the side of the grocery store, there's this aisle of, you know, pastas and things that they want to get rid of. Those the folks I'm writing about are regulars in that aisle. My own life, you know, I've had so many different kinds of jobs and done so many different things. You know, my own background is, you know, my parents were decidedly working class folks, you know, and trying to figure out ways of making the world better for the kids. My dad had an auto body shop, and which he, you know, ran on his own for many, many, many years, and so. You know, his, you know, it was, I would say it's fair to say we never wanted for things, but my mother also knew her way around, you know, the coupons bin and the parts of the store where things were on sale. But that's how most people live. And I remember, it took me a long time in my own life to sort of calibrate my brain to, particularly when I was a young adult, to the fact that, oh, you know, nobody really lives like the folks in those that we see in TV and films, and also the kinds of lives that are portrayed in a lot of contemporary American fiction, you know, the kind of suburban angst. Yeah, that didn't resonate with me either. So over these years, what I've done is try to figure out how to write stories about the people who live the lives that I've lived, and also most of the people I know.
Well, one of the things I think you do just remarkably well is to tell a story that, in a sense, if you were to describe the plot in bare bones, you roll your eyes, okay, fine, you know. But you use the language so well and understand your character so well and know how to split the time between them reporting what they're experiencing at the minute and also a certain time travel, as it were, back into the past, into some, previous existence that leads to their understanding of what's happening in the present. So it's a kind of a loop, time loop in a sense. And I think nowhere is this better done than in the title novella, Martha's Daughter. Martha's daughter. Martha is a mother to just you, the reader will remember for the rest of their lives. And her daughter does this thing where she's going somewhere to do something specific, and it's a pretty emotionally fraught thing. I'll let readers find this out. But what she does, and what you do as a writer with just incredible expertise, one second she's in the present, and then the next second, next sentence, she's in the past. And I think your ability to use this kind of time travel that we all experience, you know, because you go somewhere and you're not exactly paying attention to where you are because you know where you're going and you're going to get whatever the hell it is you have to get done. And so your brain might wonder, and you know, the classic question for all of us, how did I get here?
Where have I been?
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes, you know, it's kind of frightening, right? I mean, you're particularly like you're in your car and you're in one of these kinds of reveries, and you look up and you're, you know, 10 miles down the road, or, you know, 20 miles down the road, and it's not like you're asleep or not paying attention, but there's something also very automatic about being in a position like that, because you can remember that you've been safe all along the way and been following the rules of the road, but your brain just gone off on this trip. You know, it happens to, I think, and maybe this is not a fair claim, I'm going to argue that I think it's something that happens to writers even more than it happens to other people.
Oh yeah, no, I hadn't thought about that, but that's exactly true. It has to. That's in a sense, the art of writing comes from those kind of reveries.
Right. And your practice you, as a writer, your practice is sort of going down these rabbit holes of the mind and telling yourself stories or remembering things, and or imagining things. And so therefore it's just sort of common to sort of be sitting and you're watching, supposedly paying attention to a television show or watching a movie or whatever, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, I missed. You have to go back and listen to what you missed again, because your brain was imagining a bunch of other stuff, or it was gone down. It followed the plot the way it wanted to go, as opposed to what actually happened. And then you're like, oh, wait, where am I? But in the novella, in Martha's Daughter, what we find out right away in the novel that the task of the day is that her mother's passed away, and Cynthia's mother's passed away, and they have had a fraught relationship, and so that's on her mind. All of it comes back, everything in their difficult lives together comes back, and she's playing all of it around and spewing it out for the reader's benefit. And in her own, I want to say melodramatic way.
Well, her language is just a delight. It's also a delight, and this is one of the things I found often happens. I'm reading a book and I'm thinking, boy, this is just a delightful story. And then I realize, I'm halfway through it. I'm thinking, boy, he's just doing a remarkable job at creating a character from another character's memory. And that I thought was just really extraordinary. So talk about keeping things in the ordinary realm while I guess describing our own extraordinary supernatural experience of our lives. In a sense, we go about, we do the dishes, we lock ourselves out of the house, then you're walking the dog, you lock yourself out of the house, and then you think, okay, well, now what am I going to do? I've got this interview in about an hour. I better get in the house. And then you have to walk around the backyard, take a window out, and then your biggest hurdle turns out to be like, you got the window open, you can get in the house, but you can't crank your leg up. It's too you're too old and too stiff trying to climb in the window.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
talk about, the way you think you use language to convey the contrast of our perceptions of the present and dilute them with our memories of what happens in the past is wonderful. Many mysteries and say, how unreliable eyewitness testimony is. And I think you bring this home by this collision of what's happening in the present, what they're remembering, and how they're infecting one another, informing one another.
I think that some of this has to do with the kind of the ethos of one of the things that we're discussing in this interview, which is the fact that ordinary life is extraordinary. Life is extraordinary, right? And I think it's one of the things that's also a given for, I think, all the characters in across the collection is that I don't think there's a one of them who thinks their lives are ordinary, even though from the outside, as you say, when you read the story, you look at what happens to them across the story, not a lot happens. I mean, these stories are not big on turgid incidents. I mean, things don't blow up. Big revelations often aren't made. For the most part, it's about people getting through their day and coming to terms with something, with some, ongoing tension in their lives. But that res but though yeah, I'm also a big believer that even those kinds of moments are not, you take them in stride, right? This the heavens don't open up and new light shines, even as much as we wish it would. So I think that, but as a writer, one of the things you have to do is, and this is I think really what you're asking me about is, how do you make the ordinary extraordinary, or how do you interest other people in what may not be what may seem to be pedestrian, right? And I think it has to come through the language, and it has to come through how that's being done in the prose, and also just it's the these people may have ordinary lives, but they have extraordinary imaginations and extraordinary insights into their own worlds, right? And so, as a writer, you sort of put them in their own worlds and put them in their own situations, and then let them really open that up for the reader.
This brings to mind just a second. I realize that what one other book writer your work is directly reminiscent of is James Joyce. And I'm thinking of Ulysses, because Ulysses was conceived on the idea that every day is an epic adventure. And so in 24 hours, the main character has essentially, an epic adventure. And I think that's the way we all see ourselves. We're narrative species. We tell our lives, and our identities are our stories. And we're sure as heck going to write them the way we want them to. And one of the things I think that I loved about Martha's Daughter, the title story, was the character of Jeanine Chalfour, who gets to go with Cynthia to help Cynthia pick up her mother's, deal with her mother. And you do a fabulous job of revealing this to her as Christine Caesar, but or Cynthia Caesar. But then slowly that evolves so that our perception of her kind of splits from where Cynthia is, and Cynthia kind of comes back to track us. And I think it was just really remarkable. And you're very generous to your characters, even the characters who are deeply flawed, or might be deeply flawed, or seen as deeply flawed, come off, sweet and charming. Humans are essentially sweet and charming people in your books. And that's a remark. They're also hella entertaining too.
Yeah, people are a lot of fun, right? And if you sometimes if you can get that past, sometimes you have to scrape through the warts, or look around, see them the warts. But yeah, I'm glad you really pointed that out about Janine. Because one of the things that the narrator of the story, Cynthia, does is that she sort of sets Janine up as a joke, or a foil, or almost a stalking horse, whatever, something that she can, that's her annoyance of the day, right?
Sure, she can look
And
down on her. And
she
you
can
feel
look
better
down
when
on
you
her
look down on somebody.
much the same as her mother would, right? And so it's one of the mirrors in the book, because there's so much, as we're watching Cynthia be hypercritical of her mother and their experiences together, and also sort of setting herself in moral superiority to her mother. Meanwhile, here she is in the car, completely dissing and looking down on this young woman, who is clearly just trying to help. But yeah, I think I agree that it even maybe surprised me a little bit, the fact that by the end of the when even in the end of the writing, I thought, oh, she's she's much more complicated She's a real, just like the narrator, she too is a real person with a real life and a big heart, right? And which I also, which is a neat trick, right? I mean, and sometimes you just have to sort of trust the writing to sort of lead you to those realizations. And I do want to just say one other thing about that, which is I think it's just a it's not it's neither very interesting and also not very good writing from my perspective to just sort of set up people up to punch down. That's what I want to say, to punch down at characters and make characters be just fools.
That's one of the charms of this book is that you like all the characters. Also, I think the prose has a real sense of fun, and it's incredibly crafty because it feels like you're just revealing raw how experience. Yet you'll pull these little turnarounds and these jokes, and I laughed aloud many times reading as I'm sitting there at the living room table and my wife's doing puzzles or whatever, and I'm listening to some kind of weird ambient music, and all of a sudden I'm just laughing and guffawing, and I know it must be very strange for the people around me. What's the matter with him? But I think that's going to be the case for anybody who reads this book. When you started writing Martha Starr, was that the first book story you wrote in these books?
In the collection?
Yeah.
No, actually, it was the last.
Oh,
One of the,
interesting.
almost the last. I finished Martha's Daughter, and there's a story in the collection called How to Be Seen in Public.
Oh, yes.
And those were about those were both being written just as the book was going into the publication process, being finished. Now, with Martha took many, many years to write. I worked on this novella for a long time. There are a lot of technical and craft complications to getting that story just the way that I wanted it. It took me a long time to figure out how I wanted to end it. There were other stories that sort of happened while I was also trying to figure out what to how to how to complete that. No, but the earliest story in the collection is Taking Miss Gazee to the Polls.
And that was a delight as well. When was how far in advance was that written? And as you wrote the stories after, did you see? Because as I read this book, I think this is like a book set within like a 10-mile radius. That really captured a certain area, middle of the country. Am I right?
Correct. Although there's more variation than I think people believe. But here I guess rather than go way down that rabbit hole, I think what it's fair to say is that all of the stories sort of find their heart or their root in the area that I grew up in, which is outside of the city of St. Louis and in a small suburb called Breckenridge Hills. Meaning that even if the stories aren't there, that's probably where the characters grew up or had some connection to. That's I think what gives them that the feel that they are all in within a 10-mile radius. But yes, there are in fact I think five stories which are specifically within a 10-mile radius of each other. So, and three which are in the same cul-de-sac. So
Martha shows up in another story, and it's really wonderful to find that connection and also to see Martha live, as it were, as perceived by another character. And I could tell you were having fun with that. And in fact, I guess that's one of the things that to me seems true. Seems like these are the kind of stories you wrote and you're kind of cracking yourself up as you wrote them. Was that the case?
Sometimes, although I have to say, you know, there's something sort of cringy about laughing at your own jokes. I'll tell you one other thing about that, which is fascinating to me. Many of these stories I had an opportunity to read pieces or parts of over the years to various audiences. And one of the things that I think is one of the most delightful discoveries over the years is reading parts of them and finding and having people looking up at people are laughing at, I didn't know that was funny, and recognize that they're not laughing at the story, but there was this sort of funny moment or funny piece of timing in there that I hadn't even thought about. And so this is also my way of saying is that I think that, you know, my sensibility in general tends to be comic in the sense that, you know, I'm just sort of, I think personally in the world in kind of an ironic way. So that's my way of saying that, it's not something that I have to force onto the page. It just sort of happens. And yes, sometimes it does crack me up a little bit, particularly if it's a real zinger. It's like, oh yeah, that was good. I have to remember to say that one myself.
Very good. You know, there's a story called The Lives of Ordinary Superheroes, which I thought was really extraordinary. Just a powerful story and funny as all get out. We live in a world now that is, for better or worse, just overrun with superheroes. And you brought us, I think, one of the favorite I've ever read about, who is Ghetto Man and his sidekick. So talk about, and that story has an excellent twist at the end of it that I don't want to give away, but so talk about the creating that story and working. I think it's a story that really uses genre fiction. For me, its virtue is that you can externalize the things you're thinking and your emotions and create you, and then have them turn into monsters that, you know, scare the heck out of you, but walk up behind you, tap you on the shoulder, and then ask if you have a spare dollar so they can call somebody on the payphone. and so I think you kind of take that tack with this story. So talk about using the superhero fantasy genre to deal with rather ordinary people.
That's a terrific question. I'm so glad you like that story. Like some of the other stories in the collection, many of them actually, they were written because somebody asked me to. You know, I'm primarily a novelist. I love writing novels and don't write a lot of short stories, although the response to this collection is saying to me, maybe you should write more short stories. But people will say, would you give us a story for this anthology or whatever, and then I'll write one. And so in this case, somebody was writing a story about, was putting together an anthology that called Who Will Save Us Now? And they asked me for a contribution. And when, you know, I'm not a big superhero fan. I mean, this was sort of written before the rise of the emergence of, you know, sort of the Marvel universe as being the dominant force in American entertainment. But in, you know, when I was growing up, my brother was the one with the comic books and, you know, I was the one with the, Victorian novels. So there's a contrast for you. So I was trying to figure out for me, what kind of story I could write that based on, you know, what kind of story would somebody write who didn't live in that kind of world. And I guess, as you said, one of the things that the genre allows one to do is not just sort of be in the headspace in a different way. It also allows one to sort of comment on the larger society in interesting ways, which is what I think it does at its very best. What the genre does is its very best. And in this case, what fascinates me so much about Ghetto Man is what he is to me is he's just one of these older black men who were, and in some communities still are, the heart and soul of the community. And they're just that guy who's walking around telling young people, pick your trash up. Don't throw your trash in the street. Pull your pants up. You young people need to go on to school. Don't stand around here wasting your time. There's just one of those guys who is the heart and soul of a place and who the neighbors rely on to kind of help keep the peace, right? Because he's out there, he knows everybody, he knows how to talk to everybody, and his the disappearance of people like that are is one of the things that happens as communities disintegrate. There's a disintegrate in the book, which is what, disappears his community and kind of turns him into a superhero when the housing project that he lives in is destroyed. Then he moves to another neighborhood and becomes and gains his power. So
there's a piece here. I'll read this to you. It's from the story. Oh my God. What Your Child Can Be a Model, a hilarious and wonderful story. You write, and I think this is important, this is America. You develop a poker face, tell your best story, and stick with whichever version doesn't get you audited. And what Briggs and his father have in common is that they both believe every word that comes out of their mouths. I think, in the near future, when they're putting gravestones up for America as a country, they can put that right on the bottom there.
I love that line too. And, it's, without giving anything away in the story, it really is, it's a belief that really helps resolve the story in the best way, but also in a problematic way.
I think that's one of the things too, that it typifies this collection and makes it so engaging is that these people, their biggest problems are not very big, and they are usually the creator of said problem and also the one getting in the way of solving a said problem. And so I'd like you to talk about, because I think your sense of plotting is really amazingly beautiful. Everything is super low-key in what happens. It's not like people are getting shot up or run over or any of that other stuff. They're just going to work and trying to deal with the neighbors. And believe me, that's hard enough to do every day. So
plenty of challenge.
That's enough challenge for me. So talk about creating plots that are entirely low-key, character-centric, based on perceptions, and that have all the fun and the reward of blowing up skyscrapers and swinging from whatever, and exciting car chases, whatever the staple of the day is. I think that your stories are as entertaining as anything you could see, and it's all down to the prose and your ability to reveal and contrast what we think about, and you said this earlier, and what we do and what we say. Pretty different things.
Some of it has to do with sort of in thinking about my own life, realizing that I how many high speed car chases have I been involved in? I think up to this point, none. And I've been mercifully spared of natural disasters, et cetera. And this is not to say that I'm craving having any of those things happen, and that those things don't make interesting narrative, right? But I think the point is that even as I think about those kinds of let's take a big budget disaster movie. For me, always the most interesting part of the movie is not when things are blowing up, but when the necessary side plot that has to be put in there to make it at least seem like that there are characters in the movie, right? So, the teenage daughter, is petulant and doesn't want to get in the car to drive away from, the monster that's coming, right? And so we learn the tender relationship between the father and the daughter, which finally, comes to fruition as he, pulls her from the jaws of the monster and saves their lives, and then they look forward to the future, right? So for me, it's like, okay, what's that about? Let's spend some time. The question, a more interesting question to me, than how is he going to save his daughter from the monster's mouth? The more interesting question is, how did he feel this morning when she told him off during breakfast? And what was really going on in that house that that makes her so petulant, and how does he navigate those kinds of things on an ordinary day? That's what's interesting to me. But we talked about this earlier, and I said so that the challenge then is how do you make that interesting without blowing a bunch of stuff up? And that's always hard. That's actually the hard part about any fiction writing or any storytelling is how do you bring your vision to life, or how do you bring the world that you want the reader to experience to life in a way that is going to keep them engaged. And so that's what we learn to do as writers. You just learn to figure, okay, I've got to make it happen this way for me, and then the next writer that we love is going to find a very different way of doing that.
I think the way you do it is to give every one of your characters what one of your characters would call a smart mouth. In the way that we all have that, we all, learn to use language in a certain way. And then to, turn that into something that's really the essence of reading is to experience the writer's own smart mouth. Could you talk about
Can I say smart mouth or smart mind? Because a lot of
exactly,
characters
yeah.
don't say it out loud, but they're thinking it, right? And they're hopefully thinking what the reader's thinking.
Yeah, and so to, I guess just to jump right ahead, long ago I had many various bees in my bonnet. I still do. The old bees have left, new bees have arrived. But something that I was trying to do work for NPR, and I said, pitched my editor with the story. I want to, because at the time I thought it was the case, that people are so entrenched and so controlled by the economy and their economic circumstances, that which are the overwhelming cages within which we live, that there could or should or would be a new genre of fiction, which was economic fiction. In the same way, there's science fiction, there's fantasy, there'd be economic fiction where, it's even though the characters have their own stories and their own things happening, that economic cage within which they live is, you know, the way that the limitation that the author uses to generate ideas. I mean, genre fiction, science fiction, once you think of some, you're H.G. Wells in 1800, and you think, wow, time machine, what a great idea. And then you have Victorian gentlemen sitting in stuffy rooms and weird devices, and, you know, you get a vision of humanity's future. I would say that, you know, this book is a really excellent use of the economic genre to, you know, keep it consistent, but also to evoke all the joy, the humor, the fun of reading. So talk about the economics of this work. Was it something you think about, or is it just something that lives around you?
I think I have thought about it both overtly and directly, and also subconsciously. And years ago, I gave a class at the Warren Wilson MFA program called Fiction About Work. And one of the things I was really interested in when I gave that class was that work seemed to be a thing in the world that was missing from a lot of fiction. And I was sort of lamenting the fact that it was...
You're exactly right.
It's, you know, how often do characters actually have, you know, or how often are stories ever about people actually doing their job? That's not that people don't have jobs, but we never see them doing their jobs. And it's also the case in a lot of fiction about middle class, upper class people, you know, the job isn't, they don't maybe need a job, or the job isn't about, the story isn't about them surviving, being in survival mode economically. So I know it's always sort of been there in my consciousness. And I think in this collection, the story, the last story in the collection on the American Heritage Trail, we put that story at the end of the collection for that reason, because it really spoke, pulling that theme together. And I'm really, I hadn't thought about it as being the collection as having this sort of economic theme, but I think you're right. I mean, and because it is something that's always sort of been there, you know, in the story, you know, how to be, your child could be a model. This is about a woman who, a divorced woman, single mother now, who's got a ridiculous job just to try to keep her kid fed and in a good school. You know, in Cynthia and Janine in the novella, Martha's daughter, are, you know, working in this ridiculous corporation selling fast fashion and having, you know, come up with stupid schemes to sell bad clothes to people who can't afford them. And her mother, Martha, Martha's entire ethos is about, you know, improving her daughter's economic condition, whether her daughter likes it or not. It's there. It's very much there. It's one of the things that we need more of. We need more people writing about I will put it this way, where to a certain extent, people's economic circumstance is maybe implicitly, but in some way operating the fiction in some way.
You know, I have to admit too, that's one of the things I loved about the title novella, was Cynthia and Janine at work in that weird corporation, and actually spending time there, and how much of her brain, and this is, I think, true of many of the characters, you know, their brain space is always kind of like reflecting back, well, how am I going to pay for the next thing, whatever that thing is. Now, as for you as a writer, one of the things that I was sort of reading this, and particularly Martha's daughter, was thinking, boy, this would make a hell of a thrilling movie that would cost, you know, pennies on the dollar.
So nothing. Enough costs nothing to make this movie.
Yeah, well, you know, you could make Cynthia's Daughter, which is would be a hilarious and fun and enjoyable and sweet and moving story all the way through, and for the catering costs of a bigger thing. Have you pitched this, or is your agent pitching these as potential stories? I mean, the novella is always pointed to, and it, with good reason, as being an excellent length for a movie.
You know, let's hope that's happening. You know, the book is not quite a month old yet, but let's hope that, here's hoping that it will be discovered by the right kind of filmmaker who really is interested in these kinds of stories. I think there are just several stories that I think, boy, you can really sort of feel, both the action on the screen, but you can also sort of cast in your mind who you'd want to play that part. That's to come. We'll let the stories live out there as prose for a while, and then. Fortunately, I'm not one of those people who has big Hollywood fantasies. Something will happen, I think.
One does not need big Hollywood fantasies to read when one can read a super engaging and enjoyable collection like this. I mean, it's really fun. It's inexpensive compared to movies, and also, I find myself, it's much easier to think about a great book than it is about a great movie. And great books, we seem to have a plethora of great writers out there. Not so much in the movie world, but that's because, it's a big, 25, 50 people throwing in ingredients into the stew, not a good recipe for a good stew.
It's also economically where we are in that industry is when you think about, we talked about superheroes before. I mean, that's both a, it's sort of self-defeating in that costs hundreds of millions of dollars to create these things. And they have to make hundreds of millions of dollars to recoup their money. This is what I love about, the fiction that I read is that, these are small worlds that I know, and it's a very different experience to sort of enter the worlds of characters like these than it is to save the universe from a forces beyond our control, which is important to do.
I think actually you are saving the world from forces beyond our control, which is the people who make superhero movies. I've been speaking with David Haynes. His new book is Martha's Daughter. This is an outstanding collection. If you want to laugh for about 15 hours while you're reading and listening to ambient music, I'd say go for it. Thank you for joining me, David.
Thank you so much for having me back, Rick. I always love talking to you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.